Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is the award-winning poet, community activist, and professor, not to mention probably one of the most widely known names in American poetry today, Martin Espada, who will be discussing his latest collection of poetry, Vivas to Those Who Have Failed, out with Norton. Martin Espada, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
It's such an honor. I can't even tell you how excited I was about being able to interview you for our show. You know, I've been a fan of your work since I first ever dipped my toes into poetry. The first book I picked up was Poetry Like Bread many years ago. That was an anthology that you edited with Curbstone Press, and it was handed to me by my by our current U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera, who was my teacher. And he gave me that book, and I had no idea that poetry could look like that, speak like that, and act like that. And so I was grateful to have that book, and in that way I feel like I'm indebted to you for your wonderful work as well. So it really is an honor to have you.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad that Juan Felipe saw fit to give you that book. He's in that book too.
Yeah, he is. That's right. That's right. And that was my first exposure to poets like Ernesto Cardenal and Roque Dalton and folks like that. So it was a fantastic experience. Yeah. And now you have this fantastic new collection, Vivas to Those Who Have Failed. You know, Martin, before we ask you some questions and get into the interview, would you mind reading us a poem from the book?
Any particular poem?
I mean, I have some favorites, but, you know, any poem that you would... Actually, you know what? Why don't we do this one? Just because we're here in El Paso and we're based here in El Paso. Why don't you read to us from The Right Foot of Juan de Oñate?
I can certainly do that.
That's great.
Yes, I've been reading this poem quite a bit lately, and not by coincidence in public, because of the ascendancy of Donald Trump in the Trump era. When he talks about building a wall, as far as I'm concerned, he's building a monument to himself. But what he's forgetting is that such monuments fall. Right. Statues fall. Statues of conquerors fall. And so that's the inspiration for this next poem. And it's called The Right Foot of Juan de Oñate for John Nichols and Arturo Madrid. On the road to Taos, in the town of Alcalde, the bronze statue of Juan de Oñate, the conquistador, kept vigil from his horse. Late one night, a chainsaw sliced off his right foot, stuttering to the ball of his ankle as Oñate's spirit scratched and howled like a dog trapped within the bronze body. Four centuries ago, after his cannon fire burst to burn hundreds of bodies and blacken the adobe walls of Yacoma Pueblo, Oñate wheeled on his startled horse and spoke the decree. All Acoma males above the age of 25 would be punished by amputation of the right foot. Spanish knives saw through ankles. Spanish hands tossed feet into piles like fish at the marketplace. There was prayer and wailing in a language Oñate did not speak. Now, at the airport in El Paso, across the river from Juarez, another bronze statue of Oñate rises on a horse frozen in fury. The city fathers smash champagne bottles across the horse's legs to christen the statue. Oñate's spirit remembers the chainsaw carving through the ball of his ankle. Yacoma Pueblo still stands. Thousands of brown feet walk across the border, the desert of Chihuahua, the shallow places of Rio Grande, the bridges of Juarez and Paso. Oñate keeps watch high on horseback above the Rio Grande, the law of the conquistador rolled in his hand, helpless as a man with an amputated foot, spirit scratching and howling like a dog within the bronze body.
Wonderful. And of course, no doubt all the folks who are from here, La Frontera, here in El Paso, are familiar with that statue that stands out front of the airport. And, you know, as I read that, I got a chuckle out of it. But at the same time, I thought this is a pretty rich bit of history that is often overlooked. And in fact, what I wanted to do actually is I wanted to share with the listeners the excerpt that your book begins with of Walt Whitman. Actually, would you mind reading that, the Vivas to Those Who Have Failed?
The passage from Whitman?
That's right.
Okay, sure. This is where the title of the collection comes from. Section 18, Song of Myself.
Song of Myself.
Vivas to those who have failed, and to those whose war vessels sank in the sea, and to those themselves who sank in the sea, and to all generals that lost engagements, and all overcome heroes, and the numberless unknown heroes equal to the greatest heroes known.
It's a fantastic passage from Song of Myself by Walt Whitman. And I wanted to ask you, Martin, in relation to the poems in this collection, you know, who are the numberless unknown heroes of this book?
Oh, there are so many. And some of them are known by name, some are not, as he says. And I think, for example, the poem I just read, the people who carved that foot off from the Oñate statue as an act of defiance, as an act of resistance. Those are heroes of the kind to which Whitman referred. And then there are others we know by name. I make reference to strikers from 100 years ago in Paterson, New Jersey, an event known as the Paterson Silk Strike of 1913.
Right.
I refer to the leaders of that strike, the industrial workers of the world, people like Big Bill Haywood, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn,
John Reed, yeah.
Part of that. But I must say that when we're talking about the heroes of this book, the kind to which Whitman referred, I have to come back ultimately to my father, Francisco Luis Espada, Frank Espada,
right,
who was born in Duala, Puerto Rico in 1930 and died in the San Francisco area in 2014. Frank Espada was a community organizer. He was a civil rights activist. He was a leader, some would say the leader, of the Puerto Rican community in New York City in the 1960s and early 70s. And he was a documentary photographer who created something called the Puerto Rican Diaspora Documentary Project, a documentary and oral history of the Puerto Rican migration.
That whole last section of your book, El Morivivi, those are all dedicated to your father. I mean, those are poems about your father, right?
That's correct.
I often wondered as I was reading the poetry, not just in that last section, but actually even all your poetry in general, you know, the large body of work that you have accumulated over the many years, I realize how much of your poetry has a very kind of rich sort of imagery and a kind of even snapshots and profiles of people. And so, and when learning about your father as this documentary photographer, you know, to me, there was an obvious kind of a photographic eye that you employed when you write. And I wonder, you know, how much, in your own words, in your own way, has your father's photography directly influenced the way you write or see the world?
Absolutely. I would say photography influenced me in two basic ways. One was the presence of the images themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Those photographs by my father hung on the walls of the places where we lived, but also hung on the walls of my imagination since earliest childhood.
Right.
Secondly, however, my father had a very particular focus. It had to do with being an advocate as an artist. And he advocated for his own community, the Puerto Rican community. He advocated for the African American community in terms of the civil rights struggle. He was an advocate with the camera. So he was an artist, and he was an artist who was absolutely dedicated to making the most striking, most powerful image possible. But he also put those images and his skills, his artistry, at the service of those who most needed it.
Right. I mean, it seems to me your father, you know, he went beyond, out from behind the camera lens, if you will, you know, and actually was the sort of the physical engaged body of what his photographs represented. You know, he was actually out there doing the work in the communities and pounding pavements and traveling abroad to spread the message and to unite communities. Is that correct? I mean, isn't that right?
Oh, absolutely. He had a background as a community organizer.
Mm-hmm.
But he took a community organizing approach to his photo documentary work.
Right.
And that meant going into the community and pounding the pavement, as you say. And sometimes I was with him behind him with a camera bag, that I was. But it also meant not flying blind. It meant going into the community with a community organizer, going into the community with someone who knew the community well and making those relationships happen with the subject as a result. So he could get close to the subject, not only physically, but emotionally.
Right.
And so there's an intimacy in the portraits that he created, and a dignity. And it was a reaction to invisibility.
Yes.
And that is something that I try to do as a poet as well. I try to make the invisible visible. And now, of course, the great irony is that my father is gone. He'll never take another photograph.
Mm-hmm.
His hands won't touch the camera. His eyes won't see. And so I have to pick up where he left off, but then the images also speak for him.
Right.
And I ended up writing a poem about that, which I can read if you like.
Please, yeah, by all means, absolutely.
Yeah, this one's called Mad Love, and the title actually derives from a classic horror film of the 1930s starring Peter Lorre. But there's something else I should say about this. The epigraph, something was actually said to my father and which he used as a form of inspiration to goad him, to spur him along to do the work that he did. Mad love. No one wants to look at pictures of Puerto Ricans, Frank. Cornell Kaplan. My brother said they harvested his corneas. I imagine the tweezers lifting the corneas from my father's eyes, delicate as the wings of butterflies mounted under glass. I imagine the transplant stitches finer than hair, eyes fluttering awake to the brilliance of an open window. This is not a horror movie. This is not Peter Lorre in Mad Love, the insane and jealous surgeon grafting the hands of a killer onto the forearms of a concert pianist who fumbles with the keys of the piano, flings knives with lethal aim, moonlight sonata swept away by lust for homicide, his wife shrieking. The blind will see, like the captain of the slave ship who turned the ship around. Voices in the room will praise the Lord for the miracle, yet the eyes drinking light through my father's eyes will not see the faces in the lens of his camera, faces of the faceless waking in the dark room. Not the tomato picker with a picket sign on his shoulder that says Reagan steals from the poor and gives to the rich. Not the fry cook in his fedora, staring at air as if he knew he would be stomped to death on the street for an empty wallet. Not the poet in a beret, grinning at the vision of shoes for all the shoeless people on the earth. Not the dancer hearing the piano tell her to spin and spin again. Not the grave digger and his machete, the bandana that keeps the dust of the dead from coating his tongue. Not the union organizer, spirits floating in the smoke of his victory cigar. Not the addict in rehab, gazing at himself like a fortune teller gazing at the cards. Not the face half hidden by the star in the Puerto Rican flag, the darkness of his dissident's eye. Hmm. Now that my father cannot speak, they wait their turn to testify in his defense. Witnesses to the mad love that drove him to it.
You are listening to the award-winning poet and professor Martin Espada reading from his latest collection of poetry, Vivas to Those Who Have Failed, out with Norton. And you know, you use the metaphor of el morivivi for your father. And can you tell us a little bit about that metaphor? I know that it's a plant of some kind, and would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, I had a challenge to face when my father died. This was a big man in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
How do you write about such a life,
right?
As I've described it? And so I hit upon the metaphor of plant. Mm-hmm. It's a very common plant. It's a pan-tropical weed. The Latin is Mimosa pudica, and it's a reference to the plant's shrinking reaction to contact. If you touch this plant, the leaves pull back and close up.
Wow.
But then they open again. This same plant will close at night and then open at first light. The Puerto Rican name for this plant is El Morivivi. El Morivivi literally means I died, I lived. And so for me, the metaphor fell in my lap, and I said, you know, this becomes a metaphor for the many lives and the many deaths and the ultimate transcendence of Fracaspada. And so that became the poem I would ultimately read at his memorial service at a community center called El Puente in Brooklyn in May of 2014.
That was the first time I'd ever heard of that word, El Morivivi. It was in your book, obviously. And, you know, when I started to look it up, it was just a fantastic metaphor and you know, for these poems and your relationship with your father in terms of this book as well. So one of my personal favorite poems in the collection also is The Insects in the Soup, which comes at the beginning, the first section of the book, which is a great depiction of the journalist, poet, and revolutionary John Reed, whose, I guess I would say, his own approach to story gathering is something that has always influenced my own work, you know, kind of getting out from behind the desk and from behind the lens and getting out into the communities and shaking hands and doing the getting dirty, you know. Right. How did John Reed make it into your collection? How did John Reed get in there? I mean, I know it's through the Patterson Silk Strikes, but, you know, why did you decide to focus your lens on him for one of those poems?
Well, as you know, John Reed is a very vivid figure. And I decided that one way of depicting a strike that took place 100 years ago was to find the part that stands for the whole. You find the face in as many faces. So there are all kinds of people who appear in this series of sonnets about the Patterson Silk Strike. Everybody remembers Reds and Warren Beatty as John Reed.
Right.
What most people don't know, and the film dwells on it only for a few seconds, is that he was radicalized in Patterson, New Jersey. The same John Reed that wrote with Pancho Villa,
right.
The same John Reed who wrote Insurgent Mexico and ultimately 10 Days to Shift the World, was radicalized in Patterson, New Jersey in 1913. And it was, I can read it if you like.
Yeah, please do. Please, absolutely. I'd love that.
Sure. This is... the sequence of poems is called Vivas to Those Who Have Failed, based on the Patterson Silk Strike of 1913. Section 3 is The Insects in the Soup. Reed was a Harvard man. He wrote for the New York Magazine. Big Bill, the organizer, fixed his one good eye on Reed and told him of this strike. He stood on a tenement porch across from the mill to escape the rain and listen to the weavers. The bluecoats told him to move on. The Harvard man asked for a name to go with a number on the badge, and the cops tried to unscrew his arms from their sockets. When the judge asked his business, Reed said, poet. The judge said, 20 days in the county jail. Reed was a Harvard man. He taught the strikers Harvard songs, the tunes to sing with rebel words of the geese of the mill. The strikers taught him how to spot the insects in the soup, speaking in tongues the gospel of one big union, and the eight-hour day, cramming the jail till the weary jailers had to unlock the doors. Reed would write, there's war in Patterson. After it was over, he rode with Pancho Villa.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And, you know, about a year ago, I went to Central Mexico, to Guanajuato, to do some research out there for my work. And as I was in this really small rancho area in El Valle de Santiago, and the place was called Charco de Pantoja, a really small place there. And the elders in the community were telling me stories of John Reed.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, yeah. About how they were informed and learned about a Mexico that they had no access to until they read, you know, Insurgent Mexico.
And it started in Patterson. And,
yeah.
You know, when people ask me sometimes, well, where do you get this stuff? And,
right.
And obviously, I'm combining my imagination with historical fact. But
right.
You can go right to the source. There's an article by John Reed in a magazine called The Masses in 1913 called Warren Patterson.
Right.
You can go right to the source. It's a very, very vivid account of the strike.
And again, going back to just your large body of work and all the books you've written over the years, you do quite a bit of research. You know, a lot of your work is actually historically based. And I wonder, you know, when it comes time to sitting down and composing the poem or the narrative that you're about to write based on a historical incident or historical moment, you know, how much of the research do you tend to do before you finally, because I mean, obviously once we start to research, right, that's kind of one of those downward spirals. You can never, you'll never get out of it until you finally just abandon it, you know? And I wonder how much of the research do you allow sort of into your creative process, and how much do you just kind of finally say, you know what, I'm just going to take, let my imagination take over from here.
Well, sometimes it begins with a sensory impression and then I fill in the spaces afterwards. You know, I earlier read the poem about the Oñate statues.
Right.
And in both cases, it began with a sensory impression.
Right.
It was dedicated, the poem that is, to two people, John Nichols, the novelist who wrote the Milagro Beanfield War, and the Chicano scholar Arturo Madrid. Each one took me to a different statue. You know, right. John took me to the statue, the first statue, and Arturo to the second statue in the poem. One,
right.
And both of them basically said, you have to write about this. And so here I am. I'm looking at two different statues of the same murderer, and I have to do something with this. So
right.
What do? I have to do some reading. I have to do some research
right.
about this conquistador.
Right.
And so then I begin to fill in. And the research was not only historical research going back centuries, you know, to the Oñate, but research into what actually happened to that statue in New Mexico, you know,
right.
when they decided to carve the foot off, then pull those accounts together. But it oftentimes begins with the senses, because that's where my poetry is grounded. It's grounded in the senses. It has to be.
And again, in this collection, and just like many of your books, there's also humor or light that's often placed side by side with these darker subjects, you know, with these more serious tone subjects. You know, in this collection, you have poems like Once Thundering Penguin Herds Darken the Prairie, and one of my personal favorites, Marshmallow Rice Crispy Treat Machu Picchu. You know,
okay.
And I'm wondering for you, what is the role or the function of humor when you're juxtaposing it with these more serious subjects? What's the function of that?
Well, I mean, one reason why there are humorous poems in this collection juxtaposed with other poems that are quite serious is that is who I am. You know, it's how I see the world. Askew, I see the world from a crazy angle, as anybody who knows me well would testify. I see strange things, and you know, I think it's important for poets not only to have a sense of wonder, but a sense of the absurd. The poem about the aquarium is based on actual experience. I went and did a poetry reading at the aquarium in Coney Island. And so I may as well read that because it's
yes.
not that long.
Please do. And, you know, that's one of the things that I've always suspected, is that all of these were actually lived experiences, because that's how, you know, that's how your writing comes across, is as if almost we're there with you in these situations. You know, it's fantastic. So please, yeah, read for us.
Yes. Okay. Once thundering penguin herds darken the prairie. One, poetry for tourists. The poets bring poetry to the Coney Island Aquarium. Around the corner from the wooden roller coaster creaking since 1927, tourists staggering away, queasy, yet hungry for a hot dog on the boardwalk. We will tempt them to taste the steamed tofu dog of poetry instead. Two, poetry for jellyfish. Tonight, we declaim poems at the jellyfish exhibit. Creatures that plummet like parachutes of light, illuminated mushrooms zooming sideways, amusing themselves, oblivious to the nuances of alliteration and assonance, silently refusing to clap after the last poem. Three, poetry for penguins. The voice of a poet on a loop installed in the penguin exhibit booms out poetry and praise of penguins. Once thundering penguin herds darkened the prairie. Once flocks of flapping penguins blocked out the sun. Now they cower behind a rock, peeking, ducking down, listening to poetry for penguins, hearing only the rumble of the almighty orca opening his jaws on Judgment Day. Four. No poetry for the octopus or the security guard. The Coney Island Aquarium is closed. We skin. The octopus glares at us with one huge eye. No one fed him today. No one read him any poems. We panic and flap like flightless birds. We rattle the gate, wailing in chorus. We are the poets. Let us out. The security guard glares at us with one huge eye. No one fed him today. No one read him any poems. He unlocks the gate anyway.
And that is the voice of the award-winning poet and professor Martín Espada, reading from his latest collection of poetry, Vivas to Those Who Have Failed. We have a few more minutes left, Martín, and I wanted to ask you regarding your poem, How We Could Have Lived or Died This Way, which is a fantastic poem that really hones in on the police brutality against people of color. And you have this line that appears at the end of the poem, and it says, I see the poets who will write the songs of insurrection generations unborn will read or hear a century from now. This is a two-part question. One, how can poetry or how does poetry affect change in our communities? And where do you see poetry a century from now?
I had a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His name was Herbert Hill. And he used to say, ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. And the notion is that you take this idea, whatever it may be, and you toss it into the air. Mm-hmm. It becomes part of the atmosphere we breathe. We have no way of knowing exactly who will be affected or in what way or when, but we have faith that ideas have consequences. And what better way to express an idea in its most eloquent possible form but poetry? And so, yes, I believe not only that ideas have consequences, that poetry has consequences.
Right.
It's not something you can box or label or stamp or quantify or weigh or measure. It is paradoxically an act of faith. Where do I see poetry a century from now? I think the poets a century from now may very well be looking back along with everybody else and wondering how it is we could have lived or died this way. Referring to, of course, the police brutality against people of color in this country. The poem, which I will read, refers to eight different cases. Some of them well known, the Eric Garner case, Walter Scott, Michael Brown, and so on. It also makes reference to little known cases, and it goes back 40 years to the case of a man named Martin Tito Perez, who was a Puerto Rican musician and photographer.
Mm-hmm.
Died under mysterious circumstances at the hands of the police in East Harlem, arrested for playing congas on the subway. He was a friend of my father's, as a matter of fact, and that was an awakening for me. So here's the poem, and once again, we have Walt Whitman with an epigraph. How we could have lived or died this way. Epigraph. Not songs of loyalty alone are these, but songs of insurrection also, for I am the sworn poet of every dauntless rebel the world over, Walt Whitman. I see the dark-skinned bodies falling in the street as their ancestors fell before the whip and steel, the last blood pooling, the last breath spitting. I see the immigrant street vendor flashing his wallet to the cops, shot so many times there are bullet holes in the soles of his feet. I see the deaf wood carver and his pocket knife crossing the street in front of a cop who yells, then fires. I see the drug raid, the wrong door kicked in, the minister's heart seizing up. I see the man hawking a fistful of cigarettes, the cop's choke hold that makes his wheezing lungs stop weaving forever. I am in the crowd, at the window, kneeling beside the body left on the asphalt for hours, covered in a sheet. I see the suicides. The conga player handcuffed for drumming on the subway, hanged in the jail cell with his hands behind him. the suspect leaking blood from his chest in the back seat of the squad car, the 300-pound boy said to stampede barehanded into the bullets drilling his forehead. I see the coroner nodding, the words he types in his report burrowing into the skin like more bullets. I see the government investigations stacking words buzzing on the page of them, suffocated as bees suffocate in a jar. I see the next black man fleeing, as the fugitive slave once fled the slave catcher, shot in the back for a broken taillight. I see the cop handcuff the corpse. I see the rebels marching, hands upraised before the riot squad's faces in bandanas against the tear gas, and I walk beside them unseen. I see the poets who will write the songs of insurrection generations unborn will read or hear a century from now, words that make them wonder how we could have lived or died this way, how the descendants of slaves still fled and the descendants of slave catchers still shot them, how we awoke every morning without the blood of the dead sweating from every pore.
We've been speaking with award-winning poet, activist, and professor Martin Espada about his latest collection of poetry, Vivas, to Those Who Have Failed. It's an incredible collection. Martin, thank you so much for joining us here on Words on the Wire.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.